This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
South Sudanese leaders have once again agreed to end the war and work towards peace.
That's Mohamed Yusuf reporting details next.
Also, the death toll from the latest outbreak of Ebola in the DRC jumps to 33. Two opposition candidates for president in Mali are appealing the results from the July 29th election.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, South Sudan leaders agreed to end hostilities yesterday in the latest attempt to end the country's five-year civil war, which has killed tens of thousands of people. Some analysts say the deal will succeed only if the country's political leaders can finally find a way to work together. Mohamed Yusuf reports.
South Sudanese leaders have once again agreed to end the war and work towards peace. East African heads of states gathered Sunday in Khartoum to witness the signing of a new peace deal between the government of President Salva Kiir, rebel leader Riek Machar, and other opposition groups. The sides all agreed to end hostilities and to work together in a transitional government scheduled to last for 3 years. Speaking in Khartoum Sunday, Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta congratulated the political leaders of South Sudan.
I commend all of you for concluding the discussion on the critical issues of security and governance. These two are critical for peace and stability in South Sudan. We stand with you because today history beckons you to seize the opportunity offered here in Khartoum to marshal your commitment and drive and claim the future of South Sudan as one people.
The agreement returns Riek Machar from exile to the post of first vice president, and four more vice presidents will also be appointed. The document signed by the leader says the president will collaborate, but will have duties and powers in accordance with a 2015 peace deal. The 2015 agreement allows the president to consult with people like Machar, but final decisions rest with Kiir. Kwajé Lasu is a spokesman for the South Sudan Opposition Alliance, which consists of 9 parties. His group also signed the peace deal. He says good governance can save the deal.
It's not even that long as an independent nation, but we've been through a lot and people suffered because of those pillars that holding the building is very weak. What I mean by that, institutional reforms, justice and accountability, rule of law, giving the people what they deserve in terms of governance. All these components of the government determine the viability of this agreement.
Political observers in the region have questioned the will of Kiir and Machar to work together in peace. The 2015 peace deal collapsed just a year later, when a flare-up of violence in Juba left hundreds dead and prompted Machar to flee the country. Commentator Fulbert Namwamba says without adequate security will be difficult for Machar to work.
Machar would like to work with Kiir, but the problem is that the circumstances under which he left Juba is such that there have to be guarantees that he can bring in his army to Juba, and then he has to be within his barracks. Otherwise, he becomes a sitting duck in a country that is unpredictable.
The civil war has uprooted more than 4 million South Sudanese civilians from their homes. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The World Health Organization says the death toll from the latest outbreak of Ebola in the Democratic Republic of Congo has jumped to 33, with another 43 confirmed or suspected cases. The dead include 2 healthcare workers. Officials worry that the virus could spread quickly because Three of the confirmed cases are in Beni, a regional trading hub about 70 kilometers from the Ugandan border, with others in neighboring Ituri province. Plans call for vaccinations to begin by Wednesday in hopes that the outbreak can be contained, as was a flare-up 2,500 kilometers away that was declared over just 2 weeks ago. There are extra challenges for such a contagious disease in North Kivu province, where an armed conflict is going on, which complicates efforts to track people who may have been exposed. In addition, more than 1 million displaced people are living there.
Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa has ruled out forming a coalition government despite his narrow win in last week's presidential election. The opposition is gearing up to challenge the official results in court. Observers say one reason for the opposition's loss in Zimbabwe's July 30th elections was the split in the main opposition party, the Movement for Democratic Change, led by Nelson Chamisa. It was part of an alliance of opposition parties challenging the ruling ZANU-PF party of President Emmerson Mnangagwa, but one opposition group remained outside the coalition, a breakaway faction called MDC-T, led by Tokozani Kupe. Some say it was this split which led to Mnangagwa's victory. From Bulawayo, reporter Addie Gondo has more.
Chamisa's MDC alliance was formed by seven political parties last year. Most of its members are splinters from the original Movement for Democratic Change and from each other. In the national total, the MDC alliance won 64 out of 210 seats in parliament, while the MDC-T led by Kupe won no seats. The majority of the seats went to the ruling ZANU-PF party of President Mnangagwa. He also won the presidency with nearly 51% of the vote. In comparison, Nelson Chamisa of the MDC alliance won 43%, or nearly 2,150,000 votes. His rival, Tokozani Kupe, won 0.9%, or just over 45,500 of the total votes cast. Malcolm Flanger is a political analyst with the Leaders for Africa Network. He attributes the win by ZANU-PF, particularly in the opposition stronghold of Matabeleland, to a well-run campaign and to popular policies. He says, for example, that many rural voters were swayed by a two-year-old program of support called Command Agriculture, and also by an effort by the National Peace and Reconciliation Commission to look into the political killings of tens of thousands of people in Matabeleland shortly after independence.
Collecting everything, Kupe was insignificant in the Matland election. With or without your votes, the winning patterns remain the same. I sincerely believe that Matabeleland bought into a reformed ZANU, which has a bargaining power in parliament after 17 years of MDC's failure as their representative. Look at Command Fisheries, Livestock, and the National Peace and Reconciliation Commission. They became sellable for ZANU in Matabeleland, hence a ZANU penetration and an MDC demise. In very rare instances did we find split votes, which ultimately would not have a huge bearing on parliamentary seat distribution. What we saw in the election is a good marketing of Nelson as a person by MDC, but a failure to sell their party. The shift in presidential preference in ZANU strongholds show how Nelson was a preferred brand of a president even to ZANU members. I think that is an interesting exhibition of democracy.
The elections were significant for the inroads both parties made into each other's strongholds. ZANU-PF did well in the opposition stronghold of Matabeleland South. Some attribute the loss to dual fielding of candidates of both MDC-T and MDC Alliance in some of the region's districts, such as Nkai South and Nkai West. ZANU-PF profited from the confusion as a result. On the other hand, the MDC's presidential candidate Nelson Chamisa did well in the rural stronghold of ZANU-PF, Mashonaland West Province. He carried 216,441 votes compared to Mnangagwa's 313,648 votes. The win represents a positive shift for the opposition. For political analyst Thomas Stolle, the ruling party's victory was not just a result of a well-managed campaign, but also of a geographic divide between Zimbabwe's voters.
The sad thing really is that we have three-quarters of the Zimbabwean population residing in rural areas, and if the ruling party is to dominate that space, it means that Zimbabwe is going to be stuck with the ruling party for quite a long while. And this is said, really, for our democratization agenda and project.
Observers say that what is clear from this election outcome is that the opposition will have to do more to expand their popularity beyond its urban base if it's ever to gain national power. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Hayes Wuhib, 16 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. South Sudan President Salva Kiir, rebel leader Riek Machar, and representatives of other opposition groups signed a power-sharing deal in Khartoum. The death toll from the latest outbreak of Ebola in the Democratic Republic of Congo has jumped to 33. And Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa has ruled out forming a coalition government despite his narrow win. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Two opposition candidates for president in Mali are appealing the results from the July 29th election, claiming irregularities in the process. The legal challenges come with a runoff election scheduled for Sunday between incumbent President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita and his main opposition, Soumaila Cissé. It's a rematch of the 2013 runoff vote. Cissé, a former finance minister, has challenged ballot stuffing on behalf of Keita, who won 41.42% of the vote to 17.8% for Cissé. Sheikh Madibo Diarra, who finished third among the two dozen candidates, also is appealing to the Constitutional Court. A decision is expected by Wednesday. Keita has appealed for unity and claims the challenges are the result of panic by the divided opposition. Mali is one of the world's poorest countries and has been racked by ethnic violence and armed groups, including Islamist extremists.
It's a question that medical scientists have been trying to answer conclusively for decades. Why is the HIV epidemic so much more severe in South Africa? The United Nations estimates there are about 7 million people living with the virus in the country. Now, some of South Africa's top HIV researchers say they've proven that relationships between young women between the ages of 15 and 24 and older men are responsible for a significant part of the world's biggest HIV epidemic. The scientists used new genetic sequencing technology to identify individuals linked in clusters of HIV transmission. Darren Taylor reports in the first part of a series focusing on their findings.
Two sweating soccer teams chase the ball on a pitch of red dust. One of the spectators is veteran HIV counselor Getswana Mahlase.
Those boys that you are watching there that are playing soccer, by the time they get to 30, one in three stands to be HIV positive.
This is Vulindlela in the Midlands of KwaZulu-Natal province. According to the government, 400,000 people live in Vulindlela, mostly in mud huts and simple brick homes. The area is typical of many in rural South Africa. There's little infrastructure and few people have jobs. Vulindlela also has some of the highest HIV infection rates in the world.
If you talk to anyone in the HIV research community, like 10 years ago, that HIV prevalence in heterosexual population, women above 30 years old would be above 60%, no one would believe.
Professor Tulio de Oliveira works at the Center for the AIDS Program of Research in South Africa, or CAPRISA, in Durban.
We have a number of robotic machines for DNA, RNA extraction, amplification, and sequencing.
He's part of a team of scientists that enrolled 10,000 people in Vulindlela in a study aimed at tracking the spread of HIV in the region. In his lab, Caprisa director Professor Salim Karim points to a long silver cylindrical machine holding glass tubes of blood.
What this machine will do, it will identify that this is viral DNA and it will then separate it out. We process it, which just simply counts how many viruses there are.
The device helps the scientists to identify who's infecting who in Vulindlela, to establish these transmission clusters.
Now we can tell whether two people have the same virus or have a virus that is so similar that they had to have passed it one to the other. And then using a range of other techniques, we can more or less work out the likely scenario as to who infected who.
The main technique the HIV experts use is called phylogenetic analysis. The Caprisa study used phylogenetic technology to help epidemiologist Professor Ayesha Karsani and her colleagues to pinpoint a key group of men in Vulindlela.
Generally young, between 25 and 35 years of age, and who have these characteristics of high viral load, less likely to know the HIV status, more likely to be sexually active, etc. If you look at the relationships that these men were having, it was amongst women who were of a younger age group. And when we looked at the ages of these younger women, it was around the ages of 15 to 24 years.
She says many young women take risks in impoverished places like Vulindlela. Their survival often depends on having a relationship with a man, and sometimes with multiple men.
The men have high rates of HIV, and the women are all very low rates of HIV, so they're sitting ducks. That's when you get a very large epidemic.
De Oliveira says the study is highly significant because it's the first to identify the lead actors in the cycle of transmission as older men giving the virus to younger women.
When they age, they come to very high levels of prevalence, unbelievable levels. We're talking about 66%, and they are likely to infect men of the same age that are likely to infect a younger woman. So you get this amplification cycle across the generations.
Some critics, however, say they didn't have enough samples to prove the cycle of transmission. It's criticism that Karim respects, but dismisses.
There is a 2% likelihood we may be wrong, but there's a 98% likelihood we might be right.
For De Oliveira, the time for talk is over. He says the continent's HIV prevention strategies must begin full-scale targeting of teenage girls, young women, and men between the ages of 25 and 35. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Durban.
On his recent visit to Africa, former U.S. President Barack Obama advised talented young Africans to drive change at home rather than emigrating. He also urged their governments to do more to curb the brain drain. Obama told young African business people and activists that opportunities could be greater in their own countries. His nonprofit organization, the Obama Foundation, runs a leadership program aimed at helping aspiring Africans to solve pressing problems in the continent. Dr. Deli Ashiru is a former president of the Students' Union Government, University of Lagos. He is also the chairman of the Lagos chapter of the Academic Staff Union of Universities. He spoke with reporter Mike Mbonye about the call made by the former U.S. president.
Well, this call is a welcome development. I'm sure it will serve as some kind of reawakening for policymakers and other policy experts in Nigeria to begin to churn out policies that will ensure that brain drain is reduced to the barest minimum, if not totally eradicated. On the other hand, it is very worrisome and painful that it will take a former United States of America's president, President Barack Obama, to be the one to be telling African leaders what exactly they should know and what exactly they should have been doing to curb this wanton and, I mean, almost unhindered decision for people to leave the shores of the country in search of greener pastures.
What are some ways communities, educators, and businesses encourage young adults to stay in Africa?
Well, at the moment, all is skewed against anybody who wants to stay in Africa. Unemployment, poverty, insecurity, and several other challenges that bedevil young people. And it is the hope of a better life outside Africa that is pushing all of these people out of the continent. So at the moment, not much is being done by government, by businesses and all that to ensure that young people remain on the continent.
How can African communities counter the appeal of working in Europe, the US, and other countries?
The first is to make life more abundant for people. And in doing that, we need to first restructure our political arrangement, make our electoral process more open, more democratic, which in turn will now create a conducive living condition for people on the continent of Africa so that all they aspire to get in Europe, if those conditions are also prevalent here, it is my conviction that the urge to go out will no longer be there.
In your opinion, do you think African leaders have done enough to curb brain drain?
Certainly not. In fact, I say without any fear of equivocation that they are doing more to chase people out of Africa than doing to retain them. However, I think it is the duty of the intelligentsia, the civil society, etc., to continue to mount pressure on political leaders in Africa in order to ensure that they provide the necessary good living condition, good working environment, better remuneration and emolument for every young people within the continent of Africa so that the desire to go out will no longer be there.
That was Dr. Dele Ashiru, former president of the Students' Union Government at the University of Lagos. He spoke with reporter Mike Mbonye in Lagos, Nigeria.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Lina Armoudou, host of Health Chat. Next week on Health Chat, we will discuss menopause, a time in women that often indicates the end of fertility. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The U.S. country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. Health Chat, this Tuesday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, Jean-Pierre Bemba, the former Democratic Republic of Congo vice president, is planning to run for president in the December election. Bemba's ICC war crimes conviction was recently overturned on appeal. Politics in the DRC on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. VOA. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minutes newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.